It's been a while since we've been in the book of Mark, it seems. So we are back where we left off, beginning chapter 10. And you can either read along or follow along by listening. And we'll go down to verse 12. Hear now the word of the living God. Setting out from there, Jesus went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan. Crowds gathered to him again, and as he was accustomed, he once more began to teach them. And some Pharisees came up to Jesus, testing him, and began questioning him whether it was lawful for a man to divorce his wife. And he answered and said to them, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send his wife away." But Jesus said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God created them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, no person is to separate." And in the house, the disciples began questioning him about this. And he said to them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And if she herself divorces her husband and marries another man, she is committing adultery." A common mistake people make about our passage is to divorce it, that's pun intended, to divorce it from the context of the book of Mark. Sometimes people look at the gospel as a book of topics. Now the topic is this, the next passage, the topic is this, the next one, by the way, will be on children. And so Jesus is simply dealing with topics one at a time. But that's why context is so important, because context really opens up a passage. And that's why verse 1 is so important. Because verse 1 gives us the context. Jesus has finally entered Judea. Now, if you haven't followed the book of Mark, that wouldn't mean much. But if you have, you know he has stayed away from Judea since the beginning when he started his ministry. The book of John tells us he would make very quick trips into Judea to go to Jerusalem during the holidays, the festivals. But he had stayed out of the capital city, which is very odd because in the Old Testament, the Messiah would come to the capital city, to Jerusalem, to establish his kingdom. And yet for 3 years, he was out in the boonies, as we would say. And so finally, he is taking a journey to Jerusalem, and he enters Judea. We know from the other Gospels there's a fairly large crowd coming down with him because they have very high anticipation of what is about to happen. And so the disciples also would have a very high excitement for what was about to happen. He's finally going to clean up, to establish his kingdom in Jerusalem. Jesus, of course, did not share the excitement because he knew it was time to be crucified. This was his final trip, and he was very close to that Passover where he would give his life on the cross. So when he enters Judea, before he goes to Jerusalem, the Pharisees meet him to set a trap for him. And they set a trap for him with this question: is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? Now this question only makes sense if you add what Matthew adds. And Mark assumes you would know this. And what Matthew adds is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? Obviously, there were times you could divorce your wife, especially with adultery. But what he means is it lawful for if a man simply does not want to be married to divorce his wife? You see, the Pharisees had heard Jesus before speak on marriage. And his view on marriage and divorce seemed much stricter than the Jewish view of the time. And so what they wanted to do in setting a trap is get him to criticize Moses. If he could criticize the Mosaic law, they would have a charge of blasphemy. And you're allowed to put someone to death for blasphemy if you could get them to criticize the Mosaic law. Do you remember Acts 6 when Stephen was stoned? Do you remember why the Sanhedrin stoned him? Because he was blaspheming Moses, they said. He was, in their minds, criticizing the Old Testament law. Now, in the Mosaic law, Moses allowed husbands to divorce their wives for almost any reason. Deuteronomy 24:1 says, "If a man finds anything indecent in his wife and divorces her, he must write her a certificate of divorce." Now, that anything indecent doesn't mean adultery, because what was the penalty for adultery? It was death. And so anything indecent meant anything you didn't like in your wife. If you were going to divorce her, you needed to write her a certificate of divorce. And that was understood in Israel as displeasing your husband in any way. Now, as a result, divorce was very common in Israel at the time. But only a husband could initiate divorce. A wife could ask her husband for a divorce, but the husband is the one who made the decision, and he didn't need approval. He didn't need approval from the rabbis or the government in any way. He simply could decide, and that would be enough, as long as he wrote her a certificate. And we'll talk about that in a moment. Jewish historian Josephus even argued that a husband can divorce his wife if she burns his dinner. So that's what they meant by anything displeasing to you. There's even a sad joke in the Talmud, the Jewish writings, where two rabbis are talking about going to a certain place where they could get married and divorced the same day. That's how lightly they took marriage and divorce. And so why was a man required then to write a certificate of divorce? Because that was the only way to protect the wife. The only way she could get remarried is if she had proof that she had been divorced. And so the law has an eye toward the protection of the wife who is being divorced that allows her to legally remarry and then have provision. And so the trap was set. Basically, the question was, well, Jesus, do you agree with Moses or do you disagree with Moses? Note how Mark notes that there's a fairly large crowd now that is gathered. This is a great time now to trap him by criticizing Moses. And so Jesus answers, "What did Moses command you?" Notice how he doesn't say, "What did God command you?" This is the law of God we're talking about. Moses received this from Mount Sinai. And yet the way Jesus speaks about the law is going to tell you something about the Mosaic law. And they're not going to like it. And so the Pharisees repeat to him Deuteronomy 24:1, which they would have memorized, of course. And then the Lord responds, and his response is incredible because it's something they had never heard before. This teaching was simply not found in Israel. The Lord basically answers yes and no. Do you agree with Moses that this was a good law? Yes and no. Yes, he affirms the necessity of the law for Israel at that time. And so he says, Moses allowed you men to divorce for almost any reason because your hearts were hardened. Now, this is new information they had never heard before. That the reason some of these laws were given is because of the sinfulness of the people. Why did Moses allow easy divorce? Because you husbands were so cruel that there needed to be a way to protect the wives so they wouldn't live with such cruelty all their lives. The law allowed her to escape and to find a better husband because your hearts were hardened. However, that was not God's plan from the beginning for marriage. That was a concession to regulate a very sinful people. Now, the Pharisees wouldn't know what to do with this because they would be hearing this for the first time. What's so new is that to the Jewish mind, the law of Moses was eternal. The law of Moses, and they wrote this over and over, was to last forever. It was God's ideal. And so for Jesus to say that that wasn't God's ideal, there's a higher standard that Moses was given to regulate your sin, would be something new. Matter of fact, there are places in Jewish writing, this is blasphemous, but there are places which say that God is obligated to obey the Mosaic Law, because the Mosaic Law is even greater than God. And so Jesus obviously had a very different view. He says the Mosaic Law was temporary because you were so sinful as a people, it simply regulated to protect people what could be done. So if the Mosaic Law was not God's ideal standard, then where do we find it? Well, notice what Jesus does. He quotes Moses again. This would have been tough for them to refute. But now he goes back to Genesis, and he quotes Moses writing at the beginning. He says, here is what marriage was meant to be before the fall, before sin entered the world. God created a male and female, and they were to become one flesh, and they were to be married for life. God and marriage joined two together, and that one flesh was both a sexual and a spiritual union, and they were to be committed to each other until one died. That was God's ideal. Once sin entered the world, God had to bring new legislation because of the fall to protect those who were treated cruelly by hard-hearted people. Now, when it says here that let no man separate, the context there is the husband. We say it in a wedding, and we hope somebody doesn't stand up and say, I object. But the context here is let neither of you, especially the husband, who had the power, separate. And so what Jesus is saying is the high divorce rate in Israel, and there was a very high divorce rate, is a result of you being disobedient to God's ideal. Now, they would argue the opposite. They would say, we're just following Moses. Moses said, if there's anything indecent, we can divorce. We're following the law of God. Look how obedient we are. And Jesus says, no, you not living up to the standard set at creation shows how sinful you are. Just the opposite of what you were thinking. Now, the Pharisees don't have a response. I'm sure they regrouped. We know that they would charge Jesus eventually with blasphemy. So this probably didn't help, and the Lord knew this. But afterwards, it's very interesting, almost comical, that when they get inside the house just with him and the disciples, they reflect the attitude of the Pharisees. Matthew tells us they're flabbergasted at what Jesus had just said. And so they ask him, Matthew brings this out, the book of Matthew, well, is it better then not to marry? What a bunch of guys, huh? They're sitting around going, marriage is for life? Maybe it's better never to marry if it's for life. That seems a bit extreme. That shows you how loose marriage was, that they think that this is very extreme teaching and radical to say marriage is for life. And so the disciples ask, isn't it better not to marry? And in response, the Lord makes a shocking statement. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And the same if a wife divorces her husband. First, in this statement, note how the Lord is changing the rules. In the Old Testament, only a husband could divorce. Now he says, if a wife divorces. And so the authority that only men possessed would end with the coming of the new covenant. But what we have here is called hyperbole. That's exaggeration to make a point. The Lord isn't being literal here. In other words, if you divorce someone and then remarry someone else, you're not literally committing the sin of adultery. The same thing when Jesus said, if you lust in your heart, it's as you're committing adultery. Well, you're not literally committing the act of adultery, But the seed of adultery is already there in your heart, which is the point. So the same idea is here, this hyperbole. But remember the context. Jesus is addressing the husbands of Israel, and he also, the Lord did this in Malachi, by the way, who were so quickly divorcing so they could marry someone else. You didn't want to be single in Israel. You didn't divorce so you could be a bachelor. You divorced because you found someone else you wanted to marry. And that was happening all the time in Israel, and they were using Deuteronomy 24 as their excuse. And so that's the context. By Jesus saying, if you do that, if you find someone else and you divorce her, even if you write a certificate, it's as if you are still committing adultery against her. In other words, you may have gotten away with it under the Mosaic law, but under God's eye and under his standards for marriage, you are still responsible for the one you so easily put away. It's as if you are committing adultery against her, even though you're remarried. So if you divorce and marry another, it's as if you're still cheating on your first wife. Because you may have gotten rid of your marriage quickly, but God is watching. And God has a higher standard than Moses and than what Moses allowed. And so he's saying, you may be not guilty in the human court of Israel, but you are guilty in God's court. Because you made a commitment to life, you saw someone else you liked, and you divorced. That's what Jesus is teaching here. Now, I want to summarize this passage with four points. The first point is that this is a judgment passage against Israel. This is just like the passage we read together, where Jesus, the Son of God, comes to the garden called Israel, and he's looking for fruit. God has given him his word, his law, all these years. Jesus the Son comes, and does he find fruit? Does he find righteousness? What does he find? He finds cruelty. He finds hatred. He finds inner lawlessness. He finds those who have made a joke out of marriage, that which God had instituted. So what Jesus is doing here is he's saying, it's time for this covenant to end. This covenant ended, and it was broken and in failure. This garden has no fruit, and it needs to be destroyed. Israel will no longer be called my people, as Hosea says. But what Jesus is saying is, I'm about to inaugurate a new covenant. What the law could not do, I will do. I will make a people who are holy from the inside. I will produce good works in them by my Holy Spirit, by washing away their sins, so they won't be like this. I will bring true righteousness. And the one way that will be seen is that when two Christians get married, they will follow the ideal. They will marry for life. They will be committed to each other in love. That's one of the ways my new covenant will be seen among my members of my kingdom. That's the way it was meant to be at the beginning when Moses wrote Genesis. So this is not simply a treatise on marriage and divorce. Jesus is about to be killed. And before he does, he announces judgment on the nation because there's no fruit, especially in this area of marriage and divorce. The second point is, verse 11 is not a law that covers all situations on divorce. For example, desertion and adultery are not even mentioned here, though they're obviously mentioned elsewhere as reasons to divorce. So he's not saying every Christian who divorces and gets remarried is committing adultery. He's speaking of a very specific situation of finding someone else you think the grass is greener, and then very easily and quickly leaving your spouse for the other. If under Moses God protected spouses from true cruelty, from hard hearts, God is not less protective or less compassionate in the New Testament. It's the same God in both covenants. And so as what the Puritans called intolerable cruelty. If someone's living with a hard-hearted spouse who hates you, God still provides a way out in divorce. And in the same way, even if you've in your past divorced wrongly and you've repented of it, but your spouse has moved on, getting remarried in a repentant state that you tried to make it right, that doesn't make you an adulterer either, because that doesn't even fit this context. Now, God's compassion can never be misused. You can never use the fact that God does provide a way out as an excuse to get out of a commitment. It really does have to be a situation where a hard-hearted person hates you and life is becoming unbearable. And if that is the case, it is always up to the spouse to decide for himself or herself to divorce. It's not finally up to the church. Now, saying that, you should always get counsel and help in these type of situations. And let me just say one more thing about that. If your marriage is becoming unbearable, the way you honor your marriage vows now is to address it, is to seek help. Don't let it go to the point where this has to happen. Try what you can now by getting the appropriate help and attention to what ails the marriage before it's too late. Number three, we have a clear statement from the Lord here that sexual relations are for the marriage bed only. He says, from the beginning, God's plan was for one man and one woman to come together in marriage, and that one flesh includes the sexual union. And that means all sexual relations outside of marriage is what's called fornication in the Bible, and it is sinful. The church cannot compromise on this, even though it's sounding more and more out of date to say this. And so, young people, the Lord's will is for you to wait until marriage before you have sexual intimacy. If you're not married, the Lord has called you to live a celibate life, and he will give you the strength to do so. Now, at the same time, sexual sin is not the unpardonable sin. It can be forgiven like any sin. We don't hold to the purity culture that you somehow remain pure by abstaining. We are all impure, even in our thoughts. Purity only comes through faith in Jesus Christ and what he does for us on the cross. So, however, sexual sin must be confessed as sin. And so you go to Jesus to be forgiven. And when you go to be forgiven, you only make sure you're not playing games with God. In other words, when you're asking forgiveness, he will give it. But you should be asking with a heart that says, Lord, I don't want to keep doing this. I want to wait for marriage. And so I ask you to give me the strength to follow you. That's the heart seeking forgiveness that the Lord honors. And then fourth and finally, I want you to see the gospel here. What Jesus is saying is that the law cannot save you. God gave Israel a law and it didn't help them at all because their hearts were by nature selfish and hard-hearted. The only way to please God is to have a new heart. And the only way is through Christ and him giving you that freely that you receive by faith in him for salvation. Jesus is about to go to the cross to do for you what you cannot do for yourself. You cannot obey God's law. You cannot be good enough. The law did not do anything for Israel. And so that's why Jesus was there. When you believe in Jesus, he not only forgives all your sins, but then he gives you a new nature so that now you have desire and strength to follow him, even his ideal. Another way to say that, according to Isaiah, is when you believe in Christ for salvation, you become the new garden that God will water all the days of your life. So if you have a good Christian marriage this morning, you both follow the Lord, you're committed to each other for life, you love each other, then give praise to God, because that's all from His grace and strength and the gospel. If you're not married, remember, you have the ideal that marriage pictures anyways. Marriage is only a temporary picture, and fallen marriage is a fallen picture of the eternal, that what happens, that we have union with Christ when we believe in Him. He is the church's heavenly husband. That's better than any earthly relationship. Unlike a hard-hearted spouse, the Lord is never cruel to us. He never fails in His marriage vow to us. He loves us, forgives us, and guides us eternally as our heavenly husband. And let's now thank Him for that in prayer.